Okay. Wow, full box tonight. Okay, let's get into it. What are all the benefits of being called a monk or a nun? Is it about having more time and seclusion for meditation, or are there other benefits as well? Ah, it's an extra level of renunciation. You give up more. You know, if you do it properly, you give it up more. And you become a member of this worldwide club called the Sangha. Which means if you have your Sangha card, you can have free accommodation, free food, in many places in the world. In other words, you go to a temple or monastery, it's really nice sometimes that I wish we had more accommodation over at Bodhinyana Monastery or Dharmasala, because sometimes I go to other places in the world, and you can always go and stay in a monastery or temple. It's really nice, because, you know, this is your family. Even that when you go on pilgrimage to India, in the Jeta Grove Monastery. Now, first of all, they said, oh, you know, you're a Westerner, you have to pay to go in. They said, no. I own this place. We're talking about the Jeta Grove Monastery because there is the carvings, evidence that it was Anathapindika, or the Prince Jeta Anathapindika. They gave that land to the Sangha of the Four Quarters present and yet to come. It basically dedicated to all the monks and nuns in now or in the future from wherever. So that's a post. So, you know, you can't charge me for going in there. I should charge you for going here. I'm one of the owners. So they realize Sangha going anyway. So it's actually nice to be, and there's also this lineage. Now the lineage, now not lineage of a particular monk or something, or a particular nun, but the great sort of tradition, you know, going right back to the time of the Buddha. And that's why, you know, sometimes you see a brown robe. Ooh. The first time I saw a monk in King's College in Cambridge, I was a member of the Buddhist Society, the first monk I saw, I can still recall that. It was like traumatic, but positive trauma. Wow, a monk. And that was really great. So the benefits is something in this. It's the oldest, continuous, democratic tradition in the whole world. 2,500 years, unbroken. Yeah, it goes here, goes there. Falls a little bit away here, but then it goes somewhere else. And so it's the oldest democratic tradition still existing. And you become part of that. And because you put the robes on, it's sort of, you know, it's like an obligation, it seems. Not like a guilt trip, not an anxiety. But, you know, these are the types of robes, you know, worn by my teacher, Ajahn Chah, and worn by his teacher, and all those lineage of monks going back to the time of the Buddha. And so you have these things on here, and you think, my goodness, I better be worthy of these robes. Not as a heavy trip, but, you know, to make your spiritual parents and spiritual family proud of the tradition. And these robes are just so practical. You know, at night time I use them as a bed sheet, as a blanket. And, you know, it's never happened yet, but I've got it all planned out, that if there is, you know, an aircraft explosion and I have to jump out, this is my parachute. Just hold the four corners really big and you just float down in the air. And because, you know, I usually, you know, go Europe. You remember that? It was a Malaysian airline. It was actually shot down over, I think, Ukraine or somewhere, or Syria or whatever. So they said, what if you get shot down over Syria? I said, first of all, it's my parachute. And when I land, it's my... I just put a slit in here and it becomes my burqa. And it means that people won't know that I'm a white... were They won't realise that, you know, I'm a sort of an Australian Buddhist. Otherwise, that straight away. So sometimes, and again, sometimes people, well, why do you wear uniforms? And it's because, like, people can recognise you. So often, even in the Western places, that they've come up to me. Just remember years ago in Armidale, these kids came up, and they were tough guys. It's a low socio-economic area. I said, "You a monk?" I said, "Yes." And they said, "Cool." And these were, you know, little rough guys. You know, if you said you were sort of something else, they'd have probably, I don't know. But anyway, there is something about sort of the idea of a monk and nun which people respect, no matter from what sort of, what tradition, what place. So it's, and people often said it's just nice to see a monk in the morning, a monk just walking past. There's something which, just to see a monk, especially now to see nuns, it's inspiring. Something which links, you know, this is Buddhist practice way, way back to the beginnings of the Buddha's era. The robe. So it's nice, it's also, but when you are a monk like this, you have to, or a nun, you know, you have to live up to the robe. So, you know, don't sort of, don't amass lots of possessions or wealth. I remember just, was at a conference in Singapore, and there were lots of monks there, and one of the people, they asked, "Is it all right for a monk to wear a Rolex?" One of the monks put his hand and there's some really nice monks there. I think that, that's right, there was even Venerable Kuang Sheng from the abbot of Kong Meng San Temple in Singapore, biggest temple there. And he just said, "No, this is my plastic, $10, you know, that's all it was." So it's nice when actually you see monks or nuns and they live a simple life, which means that it inspires you. Inspires you, yeah, there are still monks and nuns in all the places in the world where, you know, that they're fulfilling the ancient tradition of simplicity, kindness, you know, peace and wisdom. Yeah, there's always going to be some who just misbehave and make the wrong use of a robe, but still most of them are really good. So yes, that's why, not all the benefits of being a monk or a nun, but a lot of them. And one of the other benefits of being a nun especially, you know, as a nun, you never ever have a bad hair day. That just doesn't exist for you. So it's great, you know, just you can do all sorts of interesting stuff with the monk or nun. Anyway, wonderful, Ajahn. Why did the Buddha... Oh, it's a joke. Why did the Buddhist coroner get fired? Because he kept printing birth as the cause of death. You know, why is the cause of death the cause of death? Okay, another Buddhist joke is anicca, dukkha, anatta. You know what those means? Anicca, impermanence, dukkha, suffering, anatta, non-self. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a pub. Or if you know from the United States, walk into a bar. Because not a joke start off with they walk into a bar or a pub. So anicca, dukkha, anatta, walk into a bar. And dukkha said, "This bar is terrible." And anicca said, "Don't worry, it will change." And anatta said, "Who said that? Who said that?" Dear Ajahn, once while meditating, my body vanished, and I felt a lot of joy. But what was left was noisy and flashy. Also, thoughts were there. The noise was just the celebration, the orchestra celebrating, the body, da 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 da, da the fanfare. That was the noise, it was the celebration of your body leaving. And flashy, again, that was flashlights and Also, thoughts were there. Was it because my mind was not pure enough for stillness? It was reasonably still, but not totally still. Remember what I said this morning? Here's the five senses, here's the mind. Little by little, your five senses get less and less and less. And look, tomorrow when you, those of you leaving, go home, you will really notice just how much you've changed, how much you've calmed down. So you may have not have noticed it, but be careful. Especially when you drive your car, if you're driving home or driving somewhere, do a few sort of circuits around, you know, the car park first of all, just to get used to things. Because otherwise, you go out, it's not so bad here because, you know, it's in the countryside. But, you know, sometimes you go outside and then when there's like a car comes in front of you, oh, just let go, and you crash. You don't react as quickly, you know, as you needed to do. So you actually do calm down. But you felt a lot of joy. Excellent. But what's left was noisy and flashy because of a bit of excitement. Do experienced meditators get into jhanas regardless of their health problems, physical conditions? Thank you. It's easier if you've got good health. Or if you've got energy, but it's not necessary. So it's amazing, just you can be sick next to death, and sometimes you just let go. So any type of body, you know, told you, you know, about that Michael had scrub typhus in a fever, getting to deep meditation, it's amazing. After listening to the Dhamma talks and meditating, I've got an interest in reading and learning more of the Buddha's teachings in the suttas. However, I'm concerned knowledge itself will be a hindrance, obstacle to peaceful meditation. Didn't the Buddha once compare grasping Dhamma the wrong way to grasping the snake by its tail? Yeah, you grasp it the right way and it's patting on the head. I've seen people get into Abhidhamma and confuse themselves as well as others. Would you recommend referring to suttas, etc., once you have a good meditation foundation, such as jhanas? Is the authenticity project you mentioned a good resource to learn Buddhist teachings? It's a good resource to see what Buddhist teachings are reliable and what is, you know, is helpful. But the way that Ajahn Chah taught, he said, the practice and the teachings, the practice and the theory. It's like the rice and curry and the sweets afterwards. The main course, the staple, that's the practice. And doing a bit of reading, study afterwards, that's like the pudding or the sweet afterwards. And if all you ever eat is puddings and sweets, you are going to get sick. But it's okay to, as long as you have the main course and then some puddings and sweets afterwards. You know that for those of you who go to our Dhammaloka temple, we put all the food out on the buffet tables. And, you know, usually the rice first of all, and then like, potatoes or whatever is bread. And then at the very end, I don't know why we do this, I always put the sweets and the fruit at the end. But, at our center in Nolamara, as soon as I say, now you can go and take your food, the kids, they know what to do. They just go to the end of the tables and take all the sweets. I've seen that so often. And you can't stop them. But anyway, at least it sort of makes them keep coming back to the temple. Anyway, so, but it, seriously though, it is important to have a little bit of understanding of the Buddha's teachings. Because, I think I mentioned this is, you know, from the suttas, but this is just making it sort of more easy to understand from my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Well, I said, like, the getting deep meditation, especially jhanas, is like having a flashlight. So you can really see where you're going. Very powerful mind. But you do need the map in order to know where the territory is. It's great having a flashlight, but if you don't know where the treasure is located, you can look here, and waste a lot of time. You have the map and the flashlight, you're going to find the treasure. On the map is the Dhamma, flashlight is the deep meditation. Put them together, and then you get some really good results. Or, like the dynamite and the match. If you just got dynamite, you're not going to sort of blow up defilements. If you just got a match, that's not strong enough. If you've got the two together and they come together, the match and the dynamite, bang! And lots of your delusions get obliterated. That is like the match, the light is like the jhana, and the gunpowder is the dharma you've known. Get the two together. You've heard about anicca, dukkha, anatta, not the ones who go into the pub, but the real ones. You heard about those Four Noble Truths, wanting, and yeah, you've heard, you know, even me put it in my way as first speaking, and then you get into deep meditation and wow, these things actually work. You really understand it, and by a little bit more letting go, you go deeper. Bang. So this is actually why you do need a bit of learning, knowledge of the Dhamma, accurate knowledge of the Dhamma, and also the practice as well. Those two go together, and that is powerful. That's why another of my favorite sayings from the Dhammapada, nati jhana apanyasa. Panya nati ajayato, yam hi jhanan cha panya cha sawe nibbana santike. Which you all know the meaning of. It means there is no jhana without wisdom. You know, you've got to have some nice insight, understand, you know, what letting go is, to get the deep meditations. And that's it. There's no jhana without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. You've got to be still to see things as they truly are. You know, they support one another, the jhana and the wisdom. And where in the person who has jhana and wisdom, when those two come together, they are in the presence of nibbana. They're right there, right next to it, with jhana and wisdom. Okay, dear Ajahn, so that's good to know some teachings. Is there a difference treatment and teaching between a Theravada nun and a Mahayana nun? How about the practice of precepts? As I know, Mahayana strongly practice only vegetarian, one of the different practices compared to Theravada. Kindly share your thoughts. Okay, monks and some nuns practice vegetarian, not all monks and nuns practice vegetarian. It's actually for me that I'm a humanitarian. So I eat humans, is that right? No, vegetarian, fruitarian, humanitarian. So, okay, that's a joke, lost on you, crikey. I think you've seen, just, you know, you are what you eat. So if you eat too many bananas, you become bananas. Oh, be careful. Okay, I better stop this. So Mahayana and Theravada, you know, there's hardly any difference at all. But, you know, I don't know too much about nuns because I ain't one. But for monks, what is it? Next month we've got a Korean monk coming over to stay for a couple of months. Hey An, he's a very good old friend. You know, spent a range retreat before. I can go and stay with them. Ah, Mahayana nuns. And Theravada and Vajrayana. That is why when people ask what is my tradition, and of course you do always like to actually to bring things together and take down the walls between different traditions. Can't we just work together? And so trying to get some tradition which is common and just doesn't divide people. So that's when I started doing the taking the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana to combine the traditions, and that becomes the Hahayana. So that's my tradition, the Hahayana tradition. H from Hinayana, Aha from Mahayana, Yana from Vajrayana. That's the best tradition. Or the old joke going around, this is about 30, 40 years ago, you know, big vehicle, small vehicle. Big vehicle, small vehicle, all vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. Quite nice, isn't it? All these vehicles which you identify with, small vehicle, big vehicle, all vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. Get agitating, we're meditating, and it becomes peaceful, and when the subtle flashes of light appear from the corner of eyes, should I try not looking at them? Don't do anything. Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I not do something? Not doing something is doing something. Just shut up and just let it happen. You know, because sometimes you say that people shouldn't control, and I usually give the simile of the car. You know, not driving the vehicle, let the vehicle do the driving. But you know, I still remember this woman. She picked me up with her son at Heathrow Airport to take me to her house, you know, to spend the night, starting a trip over in England. And you know, she knew, it's a caravan, Mark, you shouldn't really drive alone with a woman, have to have the man there. So I was in the passenger seat, he was in the driving seat, and the lady was in the back seat. Every few seconds, don't drive that fast, this is the best way, don't go that way, go another way, just look, there's a flat light coming up soon, just slow down. And that poor boy, you know, I've heard about GPS, this was GPM, Global Positioning Mother. And she was the most controlling backseat driver I've ever seen, experience. So yeah, when you try not, don't do the driving, but don't tell somebody else how to drive. Just sit back and enjoy the journey. And this is the same with this here. Just let it be. Just see what happens. They come, they go. Whatever happens is fine. So they come from the corner of your eyes, just over here. Just keep looking, don't move. Don't get excited, just carry on. Don't do anything. I find my heart rate goes up naturally when these things happen. Should I not worry too much about these and let myself get used to them so the excitement dies down eventually? Yeah. We always get excited because these are powerful states of mind. But it's the excitement sometimes just disturbs everything. Remember, like an Ajahn Chah sitting by the still forest pool. Doesn't get excited. Just lets it be. You know, I told that story, you know, beforehand to the husband of one of the Thai ladies who, you know, she was actually here the other day feeding, one of the people who were feeding you. And unfortunately he passed away some time ago. But he had a job as a photographer for the Sunday Times newspaper. And that the editor called him to the office one day and said that there was a rumor going around, only a rumor, that Kylie Minogue, the pop singer, that she had a bit of a difficult time and she was hiding in Cable Beach Resort up by Broome. And the editor said, do you want to go up to Cable Beach Resort to see if it's true? And that's just a lovely place, an idyllic location. So he said, yeah, sure. So off he went there just to make sure, no, who knows, maybe she's there or not. And of course, no one would actually say because she was in hiding. So he wasn't really a paparazzi, except for this time. He climbed over the fence, and he crawled through the bushes. And, you know, he could see that one of the little cottages there was a bit special. So he waited. And he remembered the simile which I told about Ajahn Chah's still forest pool. Used it in totally the wrong context. And he waited and waited. And sure enough, Kylie Minogue came out. You know, it was true. And so he had to be so careful. He got excited. Kylie Minogue would go back in and hide again. She'd know she'd been busted. Or security would find out and arrest him or something. But because of his training in the Buddhist temple, don't get excited, no heart rate. He said it was the most exciting time of his life. He got the photograph, and it was syndicated around the world. It's one moment of being a real paparazzi. The rest of the time was boring. Just opening the, photographing the opening of the new toilet complex in Scarborough Beach. Just stupid stuff. But anyway, that was exciting. And he said, thank you to these teachings. So when you say, how do these teachings relate to daily life, the real world? But that's the idea. Sometimes we get really excited. Just calm down. And then amazing things happen. By remaining still and quiet, those lights come out to play as you describe. However, I now find a clash between being still and quiet and the joy pleasure that starts to arise when the lights come out. I feel reactionary force to remain still quiet despite the joy pleasure arising, resulting everything just resetting back to the beginning. Is stillness and quietness mutually exclusive from the joy pleasure from these lights? No. Actually, they come together. So the stillness is just so refined and so beautiful. So the pleasure gets very refined. So I just, you know, go for the stillness, and the pleasure will not disturb you. Stillness rules. The last story in your book, Open the Door of Your Heart, is about the deva who tries to save a worm 108 times from a pile of excrement. It's not from a pile of excrement, it's from a pile of shit. Sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't use that word. But it's the word which people use. So you've got to speak in the local language. One of my friends back home wanted me to ask you if this was your sneaky way of hinting that you have been trying to save us 108 times through your 108 stories. Of course it was. Why did I mention 108? Because that's the last story in the book. And the last story in the book, you know, was the 108th story. And there was a worm in a pile of dung. And the deva tried to pull him out 108 times and he wouldn't go. So that was 108 stories to those people who were reading that book. 108 times trying to pull you out and it didn't work. And it's a great story. And I've got to say it now again because I've started it. There was two monks. And those two monks, best of friends, always hung out together and just, you know, went wandering together, pilgrimage together. And when they died, one of them went to a heaven realm, the other one, because of some bad karma, was reborn as a worm in a hot, steaming pile of cow poo. And after a few days enjoying the pleasures of the heavenly realm, their friend wondered, where is my mate gone? And he's not sort of close by, so he searched all the heaven realms. Could find no trace of his best friend. So, the human rebirth is one of the best. Maybe my friend has got reborn in the human realm. So he searched all the human realm, couldn't find him anywhere. Oh my goodness, he hasn't been reborn as an animal. So he looked at all of the really big animals, the monkeys and the teddy bears and the dogs and the cats, and couldn't find him anywhere. So he kept on searching, because if that's your friend, you don't give up that easily. Friendship is just a very strong tie. So eventually he found his friend. To his horror, he didn't know what my friend must have done to get this terrible rebirth as a worm in a pile of hot, stinking, steaming cow dung. Now, if any of your friends get in trouble, if it's a real friend, you can't just ignore them. You have to go and see them, try and help them, no matter what it takes. So the heavenly being appeared in front of the pile of cow shit, and he called out, say, worm, worm! And this little worm poked his head out of the cow poo. Yeah, what do you want? And the heavenly being said, do you remember me? Oh, I don't know who you are. Get out of here. He said, no, wait for a minute, worm. In your past life, we were the best of friends. We were monks together. Oh, yeah? So what? Well, look, worm, I have been reborn in this beautiful heaven realm. It's so fragrant and peaceful and kind. And he described all of the joys and peace and the beauty of heaven. And the heavenly being said, and I've come to help you. I can come and take you to heaven. Come on. Hang on a moment, said the worm. I just want to ask you one thing before I go. Up there in heaven, is there any shit? No, of course not. We don't have stuff like that up there. Well, said the worm, I'm not going. I like my cow poo. I like my pile of shit, which I live in. It's my food, it's warm, it's fragrant, and so comfortable. When I tell that story, I recall the story of my experience in the toilet over there, and wondering that was a sign that I was a worm in my previous life. No, that's beautiful. No. But anyway, there was, and I don't want to go. I like my pile of shit. And so, the heavenly being could not convince the worm to go. So he thought it had to be a bit more assertive. So he said, look, if I can only catch that worm and take him to heaven, he could see for himself, you know, Ehi pasiko, opanaiko, pachatangwe titabo winyuhi. To be experienced every while. When you experience it, it's obvious. So he decided to grab the worm. And he grabbed the worm and tried to pull it out of its pile of dung. But the worm didn't want to go. It was attached to its lovely pile of poo. And so it was wriggling and trying to escape. Now, if you imagine a worm who lives in a pile of poo, it's just so slimy, and it didn't want to go. It wriggled and slimy, and soon it slipped out of the heavenly being's grasp and went right into the deepest part of the pile of poo. But you don't give up that easily. So the heavenly being held his nose and put his hand right searching for the poo. Now, if you want to imagine what this must be like, imagine, say, it was, say, the Queen Elizabeth. Refined, just really sort of lived in luxury all her life. Would she put her hand in a pile of poo to rescue, say, you know, Prince Philip or something if he got reborn down there? Of course not. And a deva is much more refined than that, so the sacrifice of putting your fingers, you know, in such stinky, filthy stuff was amazing. Just, you know, his ability to just renounce and just try and help someone, the compassion was immense. So he searched around, he found the worm, pulled it out again, but the worm never wanted to go. So wriggled, got free, and hid again. And 108 times that heavenly being tried to pull the worm out, but the worm never wanted to go. So in the end, the heavenly being had to go up to heaven alone and leave the worm to its stinky pile of shit, which it thought was just heaven. And you all know the meaning of that story. I'd only have 9 days, and some of you have been for 12 retreats already. 108 days you've been. I'm trying to pull you out. No, I don't want to go. That's a lovely little story there. But with the last story in the other book, the Good Bad Who Knows book, similar story. But this is about, you know, about becoming too confused about study. Because this was the story of the professor of philosophy who would enjoy his single fellow, but he was actually, that's what Socrates say, that if you get married, if you have a happy marriage, you know, you're fine. If you have a difficult marriage, you become a philosopher. That's what Socrates said. We said a lot about his marriage. But anyway, the professor of philosophy, now he heard that there was a new restaurant opened up in town. 5-star chef, Michelin rated. So because he likes his food, he made an appointment. But when he rang up, they said, oh, there's a 3-month waiting list. And so he said, put my name down. So when the 3 months came up, he dressed in a really fine suit, because a very, very strict dress code, not like this place. Very strict dress code. And he went there, showed his ID to the maitre d' outside, and said, oh yes sir, you have a booking tonight. So the maitre d' took him to his seat. This was really an expensive restaurant. The lights were not light like this, they were just dim, but it was enough light to see where you were going, but it was dim enough to give it like an ambience of seclusion, so you didn't need to be distracted by sights. You could really enjoy your food to the max. And they sat him down in this plush chair in front of this mahogany table with candelabras, with the candles adding just that little bit extra light, so you could actually read the menu and just have a good meal. So once he was seated, the waiter came in full tails, lovely bow tie, impeccably groomed, and handed the professor the menu. And the menu itself deserved to be in a museum. And this beautiful card, not like the paper you see in McDonald's, beautiful card with like gold on the gold rim, and it was like calligraphy. All the different menu. So the professor said thank you to the waiter, and then the professor looked at the menu, and then ate the menu, and went and paid and left. Because the professor of philosophy didn't know the difference between the menu and the food. You understand? All the theory, the Abhidhamma, the suttas, all the words, the books. Don't eat the books. Look at the books and order the food. So what's on the menu? Well, on the menu there's first jhana, second jhana. Don't just eat the menu. Order the dishes and eat them. I want the opportunity to say thank you for the amazing experience here at Jhana Grove. Thank you to Venerable Ajahn Brahm for making all of this possible and make a huge difference in humankind. A difference, is that a difference for the better or for the worse? Because people say you've made a big difference in my life. Which way? To all the bhikkhunis who shared in this farm with the amazing discovery of life in the Dhamma. To Ajahn Pawun, so if I got the name wrong, for the bird who talks joke. I haven't heard that one. Do you want to share it? Last time. Oh, okay. To Bianca, amazing love and kindness to all of us. And to all retreatants for being here and make it possible a pure land does exist. It's nice actually to experience. This is a pretty pure land, living together in peace and harmony, fearless, trusting one another, really good food, good company. You don't need to talk so much to have a good time. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Why did you decide to become nuns? You ask me that question? You don't really look in the mirror all that time. Just right, you think you answered that yesterday, didn't you? Yeah, okay, very good. Could you please tell us the story of the man in Thailand who people thought had drowned? But when he was resuscitated, a different being had entered his body. Oh, yeah, that's actually not in the books, but that was quite a well-known monk in Thailand. It was actually I'll give you a clue. It's Ajahn Sujato's teacher over there in Chachen South. But anyway, he told a story. Again, another of these, like, sort of near-death experiences stuff. that his earliest memory was of this huge light and coming out of the light and being in the body of this young boy who was being dragged out of the lake. And the backstory, what happened before, which he found out but didn't experience, there was a young kid. His sister was supposed to be looking after him in a village in Thailand, and the sister was just going to do some washing by the village lake, and the kid was with him playing around, being a naughty little boy, and he slipped into the lake and went under the water. So the sister just ran to the house, called her father, called all the other people there, and they dived into the water looking for this boy. And apparently he was there just most of the day, for 7 or 8 hours or something. And when they dragged him out, they found his body was lifeless. And apparently they said that what they used to do was to take the feet and drag it sort of, upside down to the from the pond to the village to try and get some of the water out. And to their surprise, he came too. He resuscitated. And he was, so that's this fellow's earliest memory. And it does seem to be that it was a different person actually came into the body. The original person had passed away, and a new one came in. Not quite the same. It's like the body was somehow or other still viable, and a new life came in. And that became quite a famous monk. So weird, but true. And when we tell these stories, I remember just one of the other Thai girls, who comes, she's been coming just ever since we first came here. So she said when she was young, she actually saw us with her own eyes in the village, that one of the people had died in the village, so she was only a young girl. And so what happened, they got the monks there in the evening to do the chanting. Funeral was going to be the next day. They got the monks there to do the chanting. All the monks there from the village were there. And they had the coffin there, and the person was laid down there dead. And then the person came too. He said the first people running out of the house were the monks. That's what she saw. They scarfed really fast. So sometimes it happens. Are all five sense pleasures equally harmful to meditation, or are some worse than others? Oh, not so much harmful, they're disturbance. So the sense of sound is the last one to go. So, smell, taste, and what's the other one? So sight, they're not so difficult to shut down. But the two really difficult ones to get past are the sense of feeling, bodily sensation and sound. So that's the most of meditation is learning how to calm those ones down. So that you can find a way. And this is like sometimes the breath, I call it like a stepping stone to cross over from the bodily feelings into just the mind. So to let go of the body all in one go is a bit difficult, so you go halfway in the stream, you let go of most of the body sensation, but you still have the breath, and then from the breath to the mind. So just and one way of looking at it. Can we have a group photo opportunity tomorrow, please? Well, I'm a bit concerned about photographs because the reason is, I do go to Indonesia a lot, and the Venerable Sri Panyawaro, who is, his monastery is in Wihara Mendut, not far from Borobudur Temple, he told me that they have to stop flash photographs of that ancient monument because the flashlight is actually degrading the stone. And I say, the same thing is happening to me. All these photographs is degrading my face. People don't believe that. So, if we can get everyone together. But the trouble with a group photograph, you get most people there, and then someone's in the toilet. Or someone, they're just, just catching a few things or something. So it's really hard to get everybody there together. So anyway, if you want to arrange that tomorrow, that's fine by me. And a group photograph, because there always has to be somebody taking the photograph, and they're obviously not in the photo. So quite often we line everybody up, And then I've volunteered to be the photographer. So, No. Ajahn, when you had sexy thoughts of the monastery, did you have jhana yet? Well, you're not supposed to tell whether you have it or not. It's okay, you can tell about, you know, your bad states of mind. You're not really supposed to say too much about your good states of mind. But, you know, I knew how to meditate then. But this was an obstacle which, you know, was coming up. So, yeah, you do get deep meditations, but then you've got to do some more work to get another paycheck. And I was maybe trying too hard. I thought you said jhana is better than sex, and so it should end all sexual fantasies. Should do. We all know that meditation retreats is better than going on holiday. That doing dharma is better than going shopping. But does that stop you going shopping? So, you know, it's just the knowledge of it, experience of it, doesn't stop the desire for sensory pleasures. That's only eradicated with the very powerful experience of anagami. So what the deep meditation does, it subdues it, it weakens that old habit. Dear Ajahn, could you please say something about the right view and right wisdom that is the basis for renunciation in the second factor of the Eightfold Path? Well, you know, the right view that nothing is permanent anyway, so you can't take it with you, even though this lawyer, you know, every time you said, I can't take it with you, you started contemplating. Why not? There must be a loophole somewhere. So that's what lawyers are like. They want to find loopholes. So he knew, you know, he was a very rich lawyer, and he knew he was going to die soon, had some incurable disease. And so that he thought and thought, and he got the perfect plan. On his deathbed, he only had a couple of days to live. He gave instructions to his wife, go to the bank, and here's the two big suitcases which I use. Fill them with $100 notes. Actually, what's the biggest currency notes? It's euros, isn't it? I don't know, anyway. With 100 US dollar notes. Do they have 500 US dollars? No? They do? I don't know. We don't have any money launderers here? Okay, say $100. $100 notes. No 50s, no 20s. $100. Pack them, all both suitcases, as full as you can with high currency notes. He's up in the bank. And he said, now, just above my bed here, you know, the attic, place those two suitcases perfectly above my bed in the attic. So, the plan is, when I leave my body and I die, I can grab those two suitcases on my way up to heaven. That's my plan. So, the wife said, okay, I'll do that for you. No need to argue. Waste of time arguing with the lawyer. Even judges know that. So, she did that, got these big two suitcases packed full of money, many millions of dollars in there, and put them exactly above his bed. Next day he died. So, you know, she did all the arrangements to the funeral, and only just maybe a day later, she decided to go and check, see about the suitcases. And she went up into the attic, the suitcases were still there. And she sort of cursed and said, stupid husband. If he'd have asked me, I'd have told him to put him underneath the bed, because I know which way he was going. No, you can't take it with you, but you may try. So, the right view is you don't own anything anyway, you have to give it all up. So you might as well give it all up before, you know, so that's renunciation. And the renunciation is, you know, renouncing the past and the future. That's the other right view, forgiveness. You can forgive anything. You don't need to punish people. You learn from mistakes, you don't punish them. And you're allowed to make mistakes. So when you make a mistake, you tell everyone about it, and you learn so much from it. And one of my recent mistakes, only this was less than 12 months ago, because this happened in the last retreat I gave in for the BGF, the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, and we hired the caves in Chitwin, I forget what it's called now, the caves just below Genting Casino. And just, you know, it's a long way from the casino, you can't hear it, but it's, you know, a very nice place for a retreat. And interview time. And in the interview, this couple came in, a guy and girl, and it was the young lady. She was the one who was asking all the questions on meditation and stuff. And the fellow was absolutely silent. And I don't know what, you know, stereotyping. I thought, you know, because the guy's silent, they must be married. Please excuse me. But, and then, you know, she looks about sort of early 20s. He, you know, maybe sort of late, you know, mid-30s. And so I asked her afterwards and said, you know, is that your husband? And both of them burst out laughing. And when she stopped laughing, I said, that's not my husband, that's my father. And when you think about it, I thought, she said, I'm only 16. And the father was about 45, 46. And you think about it, that I thought she looked old enough to be married. And so to her, that was a compliment. She was so pleased that, you know, she looked mature. And you can imagine how pleased her father felt that he looked young enough to have a young wife. So when they finished laughing and they left, about 5 minutes later, they sent in an ang pao. You know ang pao, the red packet, you know, where they put donations in? And it was $100 Australian and with a little note, please use some of this when you get back to Perth, to go to the opticians and get your prescription checked. But out of that mistake, the temple made $100. Good at learner, so mistakes are just very lucrative. And it's also make people laugh as well. So that's the right view. You let things go, you laugh. In your past, you can't change anyway, so laugh at it, be kind to it, and it disappears. The future, be compassionate towards it, and then it's, you know, you don't worry, be hopey, and then you find out everything goes pretty okay. So you renounce the worry of the future. You renounce the burden of the past, especially the ill will. And that means that you get some freedom. Simple wisdom. From right view, you can let things go. And also that, you know, there's nothing to, no one here anyway, so what's there to attain? So you just relax. Let it go. Enlightenment is not your problem. Nanya. None of my business. Sick? None of my business. Gonna die anyway. You know, get it over and done with. So when you do that, you get so peaceful, so free. So right view, you can spend lots and lots of time on right view. There are recently many bad monks and fake nuns on the news in my country. Which country are you in? I hope it's not Australia. My dad is now very sceptical about donating to monastic. How to ease his scepticism? You never donate to a monastic. You donate to the temple. And make sure that the temple is always audited, like we are over here. So you can see the accounts. There's a couple of people, I don't know, Lucky knows that she's on the committee. So, you know, every cent, you know, has to be accounted for. So, that's the trouble. You know, monks, you know, should never have to have money. So what do they need money for? And people say, oh, but you've got to be travelling. And I said, look at me. I travel so much, and I don't take money with me. You know what? And sometimes they say, don't you take an attendant with you when you go travelling? And people say, can I be your attendant? I said, what do I need an attendant for? If somebody takes me to the airport, and then when I get into the aircraft, it's about, maybe about 20 attendants in there, called flight attendants. And then someone picks me up at the other end. And you know, one of the reasons why I like travelling alone, not with an attendant. Because if someone's travelling with me, they keep asking me questions about meditation and Dhamma and no peace at all. Because this happened to me when I was at Malacca. I forget what I was doing. Oh, it's actually the old temple there was having its 100th or 200th anniversary or something, and I got talked into just giving a presentation there. And on the way back from Malacca, somebody drove me to the airport. And you know, when you're being driven to the airport, you can't sort of get out and go somewhere else. You're stuck. So they could ask me questions as much as they wanted, and just I couldn't sort of get out. So, you know, they're asking me questions. At least here, if I get tired, I say I'm going to the toilet. But you can't actually get out of the car and just go to the toilet. So I was stuck there for a couple of hours answering all these questions. We got to the airport. Now I can have a nice, quiet time on the flight back to Perth. Should never sort of just anticipate that things are going to work out as I want. Because you know what happened? I was sitting on the window seat, minding my own business. And there was a gentleman sitting next to me. And then I thought I was pretty safe. And then this woman passed by and she stopped. And she looked at me and said, "Are you Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I can't lie. I can't say, no, I'm not Ajahn Brahm." I said, "Yeah, I am." She said, "Oh, I really wanted to discuss something with you." I said, "Well, I'm terribly sorry, but this gentleman is sitting next to me." You know what she did? She said, "Oh, so, would you mind exchanging seats?" And I was using all my powers to say no. And he said yes. And they exchanged seats. She was in the aisle seat, I was in the window seat. I couldn't escape. So I don't know, six hours. Asked me about all her marital problems, business problems, all the stuff of her life. She can't get away from it. Free counselling. But anyway, that's part of life. You can't change it, so you just have to accept it. So, anyway, we're going to get on to it. So, yeah, all that, you know, I don't need sort of money when I travel. So, what monks or fake nuns? Oh, do you mean those monks who actually just walk down the streets and they sort of ask for money and they give you something back, those fake monks and nuns? Because every now and again you have those in Melbourne and Sydney and Singapore and stuff. And they're all sort of part of gangs because sometimes people are gullible. And they say, you know, please give a donation, otherwise it's bad karma. And, you know, sometimes that. In Malaysia, I took it, that was happening a lot, and I gave the advice. I said, now if that happens, you know, because they usually go with lots of people, maybe to a market, so just ask the monk just to wait for a few moments, and then get the greasiest, smelliest of curry from one of the stores, and say, "Oh, may I give you a donation?" When they open their bowl with all of the Malaysian ringgit notes in it, pour the curry on top. It's pretty mean, isn't it? But teach them a lesson. But no, you see, you can offer food, but not money. On that also other subject, money goes to temple. I was coming back from the United States, I forget which part, Singapore Airport. That was, I was just going to just have a few minutes just relaxing and then get the connecting flight back to Perth. But the trouble in those days that I just knew so many people, you know, in the airport, and you know the security wasn't so tight. So I had, you know, half the members of the Buddhist Fellowship. They were waiting me at the gate inside the airport, and so you know, sat down. They got me a cup of tea, but then they started asking me all questions. So I'm exhausted. I'm tired. So I thought I'd go to the toilet. You know, I said I need to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet, and those who've been in Changi Airport, you know that there's many cubicles in there. So I have a toilet attendant there to keep everything clean. You know what happened as soon as I got in there? You wouldn't believe this was possible, and it happened. The toilet attendant looked at me and said, "Are you Ajahn Brahm?" Even in the men's toilet, you can't escape. It's unfair. At least he never took a photograph of me in there, but all he did do, he was asking some questions. But I always remember this story because he said, oh, that's wonderful. Can I make a donation? And I said, look, you know, I'm a monk. I keep my rules. We don't accept money. So, oh, well, can I send it to you? And so we got, you know, the paper hand towels. And I wrote the address of Bodhinyana Monastery on that paper hand towel and gave it to him. I noticed it was about 2 weeks later, there was a donation maybe of 20 Singapore dollars came through. And I thought, oh, that's so sweet, because those guys are not rich. But, you know, he wanted to do something. And that's brilliant, so beautiful. I really treasure that little donation. Someone really so poor, you know, working in the toilets, toilet attendant, but still he had enough faith that I could actually give him at least the address so he could actually send it in the post. That's what was really nice. So anyway, just all the money goes into the, the suicidal spider's home. Remember that story I said? So I think there's plenty of space in the donation box for the spiders and whatever. During my meditation today, my whole mind appeared bright. Yay! I then followed my breath a bit more and the mind became dark. Oh, let go, don't follow the breath, follow the light. At this time, should I be mindful of the mind or keep following the breath? No, the breath has done its job. That is trying to land the aircraft in Jhana Grove. You can't land aircraft in Jhana Grove. They go to the airport. The breath gets you so far, and then leave the breath there and just let the mind take you deeper. The nuns were not okay yesterday evening. Ooh. That's what it says there. The nuns were not okay yesterday evening. They were very, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So was Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu. Question. I understand that even at the time of the Buddha, other non-Buddhist meditators achieved jhana. Other non-Buddhist meditators achieved jhana. Whatever can be given to prove that the Buddhist teachings analyze jhana correctly. Is this something one has to directly experience? It was very... not proven, but very contradictory to say there was other non-Buddhist meditators achieved jhanas. They had Alaraka Lama, Uttaka Rama, Putta, never says they achieved jhanas, said they got into the state of neither of nothingness and neither perception or non-perception. And the Siddhartha Gautama, not yet the Buddha, still a Bodhisattva, said that they wasn't conducive to enlightenment. Later on, in places like the Atikanagara Sutta, said that they were conducive to enlightenment. So there's a contradiction there, right in the suttas. The Buddha says one thing in one place, another thing in the other place. But they, very unlikely that those were based on jhanas. Otherwise, why would the Buddha have to reflect all the time when he was a young kid to remember the jhanas? It is more convincing that those two teachers did not teach jhanas. They teach these two states which were not based on jhanas. They weren't the real thing. The other piece of evidence, which is really convincing, was the one of the disciples of the Buddha was a person called Chitta. He was a general formerly, and that he was very well known in the area, and that one day he went to see Mahavira, otherwise known as Nataputta, the founder of the Jains. And it was a historical anomaly that, you know, why this actually happened. The Buddha and the founder of the Jains appeared, you know, in the same part of India at the same time in history. Two major world religions appearing, you know, together. And Mahavira was, or Nataputta as it's said in the Buddhist canon, was centered in Nalanda. You know, just, you know, not that far, well, it's walking distance. You know, from the Vulture's Peak, the Bamboo Grove, and many of you who've been on pilgrimage, you know this, Nalanda, the great university, the birthplace of Sariputta, and that was also the place where Mahavira lived. The Jains, two huge religions, the same place, the same time almost. Anyway, that Chitta went to see Mahavira. So So these were, you know, the opposition, if you like. And so many of some of the rules which the Buddha did, like, you know, not cutting trees, you know, they did that because the Jains would not do that. So as many of those rules, you know, were literally keeping up with the Jaineses. It was true. We told that joke during the video class. But, so, Chitta went to see Mahavira, and Mahavira said, "Oh, here comes a well-known disciple of the Buddha." I said, "He should know this. We were just talking and discussing this crazy idea coming from your teacher that through meditation you can stop thoughts. You can have a state of awareness without thoughts. What do you think of that, Chitta? Do you believe that?" And Chitta, the householder, Chitta said, "No, I don't believe that at all." And Mahavira smiled and said, "See? A prominent disciple of the Buddha also agrees with me that you cannot stop thinking. Impossible. It's like putting your fist in the Ganges and trying to stop the current. It cannot be done." And you see, this is confirmed by one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, lay disciples. And Chitta was sitting there quiet all the time and said, "Yes, exactly. I don't believe that. I know that. Because I can get into jhanas." He was an anagami. And Mahavira said, "These disciples of the Buddha are sneaky and tricky. It's really hard to have a really good conversation with them." And that's a sort of bit of fun and games. But what it did reveal was even the Mahavira, the most prominent teacher, probably even at the time, some historians think was more famous, had more disciples than the Buddha at that time, than either of the Jains, but certainly would have known a lot. Never thought it was possible to stop thinking. Had no experience of jhanas, or even knowledge that they could be possible. And it does say in the suttas, the Buddha who discovered jhanas. So, that is very unlikely that other people in the time of the Buddha had jhanas, other than his disciples. Dear Ajahn, further to the question answered yesterday, if Buddhism will survive long with the introduction of Dharma via the internet, will more people get to hear it? If Buddhism survives for 2,600 years without forced conversions and killings and war, will the future generations go to hear the Dharma in their busy lives? Well, you're already listening to that Dharma in your busy lives. It's not just the internet. It's just when you get to sit next to a monk on the aircraft. Or not in the internet, even in the men's toilets in Changi Airport. So the ability to listen to Dharma is actually quite huge. But sometimes it's not even listening. It's actually just seeing examples. Peaceful examples. Just like that was the story of Asoka, so a very peaceful monk or novice, and that just changed his whole life. Or just, it was Sariputta seeing Asaji, just walking so peaceful. You know, so this is something amazing. The Buddha's first five disciples, it was his demeanor which convinced them that this was something special which he had found. So sometimes to spread these great teachings, which are very beneficial, sometimes it's not the words, but something else which really spreads it. That's why I call it brainwashing. You see a good example, something peaceful, something you can feel is amazing. And that is more important than what's said, where it comes from. About the problem of saliva during meditation, I realize you can't swallow and breathe at the same time. So swallowing does not break my mindfulness. It only disturbs the rhythm of breathing. And breathing in and out my mind was getting used to. So I can mindfully swallow and then just continue my breath in meditation. I hope this can help others with the same problem. Yeah, give it a try. It doesn't matter if you do dribble, because you can always get a bib. They're very cheap. You know, you can buy get one from your daughter or something who's had a baby, and the baby's grown up now. So, gratitude to you, Ajahn, and everyone who helped organize this wonderful retreat. Special thanks to Bianca. Enjoyed every bit of it. Only spoiler was my allergy, not allergy to meditation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I wonder what your allergy is, too. So anyway, no one is perfect. So sometimes we have an allergy to this, an allergy to that. So I've got hay fever, but there's no real hay over here. So sometimes we just have to work with what we've got. I think I did tell you that, you know, I found out that I was suffering from a contagious disease. You know, the hepatitis B? This cannot hepatitis, happy-titis. Very contagious, happy-titis. B for Buddhism. Dear Ajahn, your generosity in all the volunteers at Sangha at China Grove has been overwhelming. It has put my own capacity to give without expecting anything in return into question. I want to give my sincere thanks in teaching me this profound lesson, and I leave this retreat with a renewed commitment to work towards the betterment of all beings, selflessly. Much great gratitude and metta. You know, giving, not expecting anything in return is just such a beautiful thing. And, you know, often, you know the answers, but sometimes all these people who come to offer dharma to you, all those people over the road there, they come and offer food every day to the monks, and some of them, I say, have been coming there for 33 years, 34 years. The only time they miss is they're on holiday or they're overseas, or they're, if they don't come, they're really sick. And I ask them, they get up really early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's, you know, just they've gone shopping beforehand, the day before. And then they come and they just make sure that they start cooking and it's really good food. You know, sometimes it happened, some of the Thai ladies used to come here, the husbands would complain. And they complain in front of me. They say, my wife doesn't cook nice food like this for me. And the wife would turn around, yeah, because you're not a monk. Ordain and you'll get some. And they do all of that. And when they sort of come, if it's some for a big occasion or something, I can understand that. Well, every day for years? And so, you know, every now and again you ask them, you know the answer. But, you know, when other people are in hearing, they say, why do you come here for such a long time? And they say, because we get so much happiness here. You get so much happiness from giving. And there's not much which I can do to give, but every now and again you have these opportunities. And this one time about a year ago, you know, that I collect these iPads, you know, to bring back to, you know, to give you on the during the meditation retreat. But I was transiting in Changi Airport again, and there was this Western girl, and, you know, she was trying to get some sleep. She was on one of the couches, and she was, you know, tossing and turning and trying to put her hand over her eyes because it was just too bright. And so I got out one of my iPads and said, here you are, I have these. And she looked at me and gave me this huge big smile and put them on so she can get to sleep. It didn't cost me anything. I had lots there in my bag, for you. We still got lots left. And I get lots of happiness out of that. I know, didn't have any money to give her, but I had something which was really useful. It's beautiful when you do things like that. You don't expect anything back in return, but my goodness, you get heaps back. There's any chance to give. And you can't do that very much as a monk, except by giving dharma, or sometimes by opening the door for you. I love doing that. So, whatever you can do to give is beautiful. Ajahn, can jhanas replace sleep? They reduce sleep, and if you get, you know, jhanas regularly, you, you know, hardly sleep at all. So, almost. Thank you for the wonderful retreat and for your teaching. Finally, I'm enjoying my meditation. Oh, crikey. That really makes me happy. I've given something. Just the fact you can enjoy meditation. Because sometimes meditation has this terrible, you know, thing. It's religious. You're supposed to do it. But, you know, people don't really have fun with it and they don't enjoy it. And I enjoyed, as a layperson, as a young one, I enjoyed my meditation so much. That's why you wanted to share it with people. You don't want to sort of give you a hard time or torture you. So when you enjoy the meditation, that makes me very happy. And it also knows once the enjoyment starts coming up, it's going to take over and you're going to really get some big happiness. What made you choose to become a forest nun? Aren't you scared of all the wild animals? The wrong question. But look, there's more wild animals in the city than there are in the forest. And you know that. You just bikies, thieves, robbers. Wow, there's huge wild animals out there in the forest. Sorry, in the city. But you go in the forest and it's wonderful. You seem much kinder than your teacher, Ajahn Chah. Why is that? No way. But, you know, sometimes it depends on the reputation of Ajahn Chah. I actually lived with Ajahn Chah, so you know who he was, and he was incredibly kind. So that sometimes people have all of these hagiography, all these rumors about who Ajahn Chah was and what he did. And soon you have, when I die, rumors, Ajahn Brahm could read my mind. He knew what the question was going to be before I even asked it. That's so much going, my young. Just a bit of good luck, that's all. So anyway, Ajahn Chah was really kind. And anyway, much kinder? I don't know. Just we don't judge, but he was certainly kind enough. Do you think dogs can meditate? I've got two Jack Russells who are usually very busy and bark at other dogs that go past the house. They also hate the postman and can hear him a mile away. However, when I met her, they went outside my room to come in. When they see me pick up my blanket and speaker, I do guided meditation. The dogs get either side of me and close their eyes and don't move, not even when they hear the postman. Sometimes they rest their heads on me. That's called sloth and torpor. So it's obviously they are meditating. They've got hindrances. Is there any way to explain this? Of course. You know, the dogs, you know, they can pick up on what you're doing. You know, I say the dogs can meditate. Don't know if they get into jhanas, but sometimes you see them sleeping, and they sort of, you know, you can see their tail wagging or their little paws moving and stuff. So they're having some great fantasy there somewhere. And it's the same when they're meditating. Why not? Ajahn, could you please explain how to open the door to your heart when in pain? Yeah, you get the knife of letting go. So when you're in pain, you know, you find if you close the door of your heart to it when you're in pain, the pain gets worse. So just experience the pain however you can, and just see, just with the, you know, just the mindfulness, what makes the pain less, what makes the pain worse. So just experiment, trial and error, and you find sometimes, yeah, the pain has got less. Why? And you'll find that is what we mean by opening the door of your heart. That's what compassion means. That's what letting go means. Because sometimes people say, yeah, we know letting go, you should let go, but how do you let go? This is how you train yourself to let go. Not in the theory, but try your body, you've got a pain and ache. If you let go of control, let things be, relax, you find the pain gets less. That's compassion. The old story, my mum, whenever I used to play soccer in the street, falling on the ground, getting sort of scabs on my knees, and because of the blood drying off, every time I'd hurt myself, my mother would kneel down and kiss the wound. And the pain would always go away, every time. Kiss it better, she would say. And never got infected. A mouth with so many germs on an open wound, no infection at all. Just the kindness was so incredibly powerful. And I thought that was obvious. That was just my life. You get a mother, just you're really in pain or bleeding, and kiss it, and then it would go. And just the power of kindness and compassion just relaxes and heals. Which is one of the reasons why that you start playing around with that with your own pains, you know, being kind to your body. Just, I was going to say this earlier, if you've got a sore elbow, kiss it better. Have you ever noticed you cannot kiss your elbow? It's impossible. Cannot be done. Now what will happen? You'll try that, won't you? Just shows you just how rebellious, how little faith people have. It can't be done, you know. But anyway, somebody like a mother, someone who loves you kind, and they kiss it better, and you get this beautiful compassion, and it heals it. That's how you learn what compassion is. Kindness. By its result. Relaxes, heals, pain disappears. So you try that on your body, and when you learn how to relax the body, take away pain, that was compassion. So that's what you learn. Not from the books, but from your experience. And that's how you learn how to open the door of your heart. It's amazing. Dear Ajahn, are the eye masks ours to keep? No. They don't belong to you. They're entrusted to you. And when you finish with them, you can give them to someone else. So you can keep them until the time you become fully enlightened. And then pass them on to your disciples. Yeah, of course they're yours. They don't belong to me. They don't belong. Just make use of them. So yeah, you can take them away. We take medicine sometimes with the clear intention of killing bacteria. You murderer. How do you reconcile this with the first precept? Now, the Buddha's very practical. If he can see it, then he'd have intention to kill it. If he can't see it, if it's microscopic, then it doesn't fall within the five precepts. It doesn't fall within the first precepts. So, you can put, when you're supposed to be cleaning up your rooms, if you clean up your rooms, you can put the disinfectant into the toilet bowl, and as you put it in there, say, die, bugs, die. No, you don't get that crazy. So you just do it. That's not breaking the first precept. Some years ago, I watched a documentary about a man who had a heart transplant. The man was a drinker, smoker, abusive to his family, and virtually illiterate. After he received the new heart, he completely changed into a loving, caring man and started writing profound love poems. Because of such a change, they got permission to trace the donor. He was a Scottish poet who was renowned for his work in the community. Can you explain this, please? Yeah, I remember reading books about that, but usually it only lasts for a few days. There was this amazing case of a young girl who had a heart transplant, and when she came out of hospital and got home again, she had nightmares. And the nightmares was of being murdered. And of course, you know, the mother sort of was a bit concerned. She went to see the surgeon and said, oh no, trauma of the operation, just it'll pass. But she had the same nightmare again and again. So the mother was actually quite sort of concerned. So she went to the police station. And she said, my daughter, you know, has had a heart transplant and she keeps remembering this event. And the police were so amazed it corresponded to an unsolved murder case. And the police had the authority to go to the surgeon and find out where that heart came from. And it was from this person who'd been murdered. And based on this child's recollections, they interviewed a suspect and he confessed to the murder. Solving a murder from the recipient of the donated heart. Amazing, isn't it? So, I don't know who was wearing those eye shades before, but maybe if I put them on, maybe you might get just the whiff of the great men. No, it seems to be that, you know, the memory, is it sort of connected to some of the, you know, memory's not just in the brain, but sometimes it's another part of the nervous system. And of course the heart has a lot of the nervous system in there. Or is it the case that the the person who was killed, you know, their ghost, if you like, was actually attracted enough to the former heart that it could actually just get into the kid's memory and just to tell who killed who. But usually after a few weeks, it vanishes, all the memories vanish away, and the person becomes their old self. It was wonderful to listen to the bhikkhunis last night. Could not believe that they were so good. This is our hidden resource, and so it's time that you did the 9-day retreats next time. We'd like to hear them more. The visiting monk was also very good. Before we allow any monks to visit here and stay here, we do quality control first of all. So we don't get any riffraff into this monastery. So he's a very, very... And he, Pratt Woon, he used to look after me in Wat Chaitawan in... Is that Kuala Lumpur, PJ? PJ, okay. He used to look after me over there every time I went to visit over there. So there's always a lot of gratitude for him. He always made sure I was well looked after. So it's nice, you know, this is wonderful about friends. You know, brothers in the Dharma, say, brothers and sisters in the Dharma, family. So we look after one another. So, of course, we only allow high quality and also high quality women. Check them out. And then, if they do QC stamp. We actually should put that tattoo somewhere. QC. Approved by Ajahn Brahm stamp. No, they're very, very good. And it's also just, you can see they're relaxed as well. So, you know, just the teaching of being peaceful, kind, not forceful, not angry, not telling people off. And just to see them just so calm and quiet, it's very nice. So thank you for all the lay people in this retreat for making my first retreat such an enjoyable one. Thank you to the people that bring Dana daily and Bianca for taking wonderful care of us. Thank you, monks and nuns, for your wisdom shared yesterday. I learned a lot from walking meditation sharing. And thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for all your wisdom and for setting up China Grove, truly the most peaceful place on earth. Thank you for teaching me how to meditate. No question. Thank you to your wisdom here. Very good. So where's the complaints going? Oh, I told you, that's right. You've already given the complaints to Bianca. Only the praise comes in. That's very nice. How do I know that my arms have disappeared and they didn't just get numb during meditation? Just open your eyes and see if you're armless. Of course, they don't get numb. It's just, you know, just trust the process. You know what numb feels like? It's unpleasant. When it disappears, it's not numb. It's just not there. I came to a perfect stillness in most of my sitting meditations. Spend good part of my sitting during the state, however, doesn't seem to go beyond. What should one be doing during stillness? If it's perfect stillness, you can't improve on perfection. So please remember that saying about on the t-shirt, nobody's perfect. I'm a nobody, therefore you're perfect. End of problem. So if you're still, what you'll be doing during stillness is stay there and wait. Build up your credit, and then the paycheck will come. Is it listening to silence or waiting for breath to appear again? Please explain. Thank you so much for the wonderful retreat and your great wisdom. You know, no one's actually complimented me on my jokes yet. Just my wisdom for setting up this place. There must be a reason for that. But anyway, there's two types of waiting. I haven't mentioned this yet. Waiting for something to happen and waiting in this moment. One is waiting in the future. When's the mango going to fall? When's it going to happen? I've been sitting silent for such a long time. Come on, I haven't got all day, you know. That is waiting in the future. That's not real patience at all. People confuse that as patience. Just waiting, come on, come on, come on. But no, there's real waiting, is waiting in this moment. Like the waiter waits on the table, always aware of this moment, knowing what their clients want. Are the positives that come from making merit, offering to monks and nuns, the same as generating good karma by doing kind things for people? You mentioned giving to enlightened monks and us makes greater merit. How did the Buddha know this? Can you explain? Yeah, more bang for bucks. In other words, if you say, you know, give some money to a sort of an alcoholic, you know, what would happen? Just they buy some more whiskey or more drinks. But if you actually just donate that money to like a place which is a refuge or a place where alcoholics can get a good night's sleep, warm, safe, and look after them, and maybe get some counseling and find out why they're alcoholic, obviously you make much, much better results. So one of the reasons why offer to a monastery or to a hospital. Hospitals are great, but you know that sometimes that the doctors, they learn from monasteries that how to care. Not to cure, but to care is more important. And you learn so many little other techniques, like, you know, compassion takes away pain. There's so many other stuff which you learn here. So, you know, this is, you know, a big hospital. It's a big university. It's the way you learn so much and you get inspired. So that's why sort of, you know, making sure that good monasteries, good nunneries, good retreat centers are well supported, that has a huge benefit. You can see how that works. Just, you know, how people can come here. Number one, they like meditating afterwards. They get compassionate. They're much better doctors, psychologists, nurses, wives, children. It's amazing just the result of this. So that's why, if it's a good organization, not to enlighten monks and nuns, but, you know, to their projects, great. What should one do if one has chronic pain which cannot be diagnosed? First of all, please trust people. They say, I'm in pain. Say, yeah, nothing wrong. You're just being a hypochondriac. You know, that story of the hypochondriac who went to see his doctor and said, I think I've got bird flu. You're not a bird. And why do you always come? Whenever you read in the paper, you think you've got it. You're just a hypochondriac. The doctor really gave it to him because he was fed up with this guy always coming and wasting his time. There's nothing wrong with you. Perfectly fit and healthy. Just get out of here. Had enough of you, hypochondriac. And this gentleman was just so, felt so rejected and so shocked. He staggered out of the doctor's surgery, not knowing where he was going, and got hit by a truck and killed. And the doctor sort of heard the sound and ran out and said, oh my goodness, I was too tough on him. And was so shocked, even the doctor had a heart attack. He died as well. So the two of them died, and so they were buried, you know, in the same cemetery in adjacent graves. And the first day after they were buried, the doctor was woken up because the hypochondriac was banging on his coffin. He said, what do you want now, said the doctor. He said, have you got anything for worms? Joke. Oh boy. So, if someone ever comes up and says they're hurting, please, you know, don't tell them they're making it up, because to them it is hurt. So, in other words, that you see what you can do. First of all, acknowledge them and trust them and don't. And a person, just give them importance and trust their symptoms. They're feeling it. And so sometimes they say, they try to meditate, you can only count one or two breaths and then the pain gets too much. Don't count the breaths. Now what to do is always to say that whatever's in front of you is the most important thing in the world. So if it's the pain, be with the pain. Someone has said she is possessed or it's all in your mind. Oh my goodness sake, that makes it so much worse. She has even said sometimes the pain gets too much so she doesn't know how to live. It doesn't help when people just don't acknowledge it and say you're making it up. So, first of all, be kind and respectful enough. She said, that's what you're feeling. That's what you're feeling. And number two, to say make that the object of your meditation. Don't try and get rid of it. Care for it. The simile of the anger eating monster is brilliant. Just, no, don't try and get rid of it. Just, no, just, if you can't beat them, join them. Be with them. Be kind. That's something you can always do. This moment is here. Give it importance and care for it. That's incredibly powerful. But the worst thing is when people think that you're not hearing them, you don't understand them. The Buddha sometimes used similes like a strong man drowning a weaker man when referring to controlling and suppressing angry thoughts. Strong man drowning a weaker man, that's, you know, it doesn't sound like Buddhism to me. But, you know, sometimes they put these things in there, and sometimes you wonder, where's that really coming from? Or they have, for example, the English saying, to kill two birds with one stone. So we don't use that. We change it in Buddhism, to cut two carrots with the same knife. So it is a little bit of cultural change. I was wondering how we can reconcile this with what you have been teaching, that is, to make peace and be kind to our anger, etc. What are your views on this? A strong man drowning a weaker man, what does that sort of teach you? So, no, that doesn't make any sense to me. I can really feel some restlessness today, and I know I will feel none of it once I get back. Any tips on how to meditate better to handle this? Thank you for your wisdom. Don't fight the restlessness. A lot of time restlessness, tomorrow, you're already planning what you're going to do. How many of you packed your bags? That's ridiculous. You haven't left yet. So, for goodness sake, if you packed your bags already, unpack them tonight. And don't pack them till the last minute. Get in this habit of living in the present moment and just squeezing as much out of this retreat. It's a 9-day retreat, not an 8-day retreat. Ain't finished yet. And who knows, maybe I ring up the airport and they say, I'm sorry that there's been a difficulty, everyone's gone on strike, there's been a terrorist attack, so you can't go on the aircraft tomorrow, so you've got another day here. Yay! Who knows, the future is uncertain. So please, don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. My favourite saying. Don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. It's going to happen one night. Imagine you've got all the washing done, all the dishes done, and it's your last night on earth. What a waste of time that was. Most grateful thanks for all you have done and keep doing for the Buddha Sasana, for the benefit of all beings everywhere, especially us in WA. We are extremely fortunate you came and stayed and made your base here. Not my fault. I never told you actually why I came here. Because I made a resolution when I started staying with Ajahn Chah, I would never ask to go anywhere. I'd wait until I was sent. So Ajahn Chah would say, go over to that monastery. I would go, no argument, no sort of preferences. And then when he asked me to come back, I would come back. I just let go of my will, my preferences, and just a nice little practice, I would go wherever he sent me. So Ajahn Chah sent me to Perth. And about a month after Ajahn Chah sent me to Perth, he had a stroke and he couldn't give orders anymore. And that's why I've been stuck here ever since. And that's the truth. Thank you, Ajahn. We are truly blessed. Wishing you long life, excellent health, peace and contentment. Peace and long life. Long life and excellent health. You can't have both. And Venerable, when you first became a Buddhist nun, here we go, did your family object to it? Yes, because they thought I was a monk. They thought I was a male. That's why they were it's not to me. So, did you have any objections? Any of you? Probably not. Anyway, you can answer that question afterwards. It's only two questions. I'm over time, so please. Oh, three questions. I hope you don't mind. Can you please explain the meaning of to be aware of what is happening in the moment in meditation? Mindfulness. 8 days I've been teaching you, and you still don't know what mindfulness is? I'm going to go and become a nun. No, just learning just how to be right now. No past, no future. Being in the moment, being silent. That's awareness. Can you please tell us a bit about your nunnery and the process of building it? Because I haven't got a nunnery. I've got a monkery. Why do they call it nunneries and not nudsteries? Like monsteries. That's not monsteries, monasteries. No, not monsteries. Dear Ajahn, doing samatha lista jhana by doing vipassana lista, the path of nirvana, what are your comments? That is gomayam. You need samatha and vipassana to get jhanas and nirvana. You can't have one without the other. So that is not the word of the Buddha. No, one more. Let's put those nunneries first. Oh yeah, this is all nunneries. So I pass these questions. When you first became a Buddhist nun, did your family object to it? Can you please, if your family do object, if any of you really want to aspire to being a Buddhist nun, what a wonderful gift that is in this world. You've seen examples of how they can inspire and just, you know, to lead a community and to make Buddhism as it was in the earliest days equitable. You don't care if you're a monk or a nun, if you're Caucasian, if you're Asian, if you're African, it doesn't matter. Just, you know, as long as you're willing to wear the robes with sincerity and with respect to what they mean and inspire other people, what a wonderful thing that is. And so, if somebody stops you from doing good karma, that's really bad karma. So I tell this to people, that if your daughter wants to become a nun, or your son wants to become a monk, and you stop them, that's really bad karma. That's really unfortunate. So I tell that because some people become so superstitious when I tell them, if you don't let your son become a monk, it's really bad karma. Really big bad karma. Really terrible bad karma. Okay, go off, become a monk now, quick. Because it is true, stopping people doing good karma, that's a wonderful thing to do. As I used to tell Dr. Kesari Dharmananda, in Malaysia in particular, but many other countries as well, people are so inspired when their daughter becomes a nun. When somebody's daughter becomes a nun, but as long as it's not your daughter. In other words, my daughter, no, not mine. Because sometimes people feel that the mothers and fathers, they feel this, they think they've made a mistake. How come that, you know, they've often become to a monastery, it must be some terrible thing. It's not, it's a wonderful thing to do. And of course, you know, you can see the quality of people who become monks and nuns. You know, they're not sort of the dregs of society. They're people of, they could be very wealthy, successful in the lay life. So it's not as if they become monks or nuns because they've got nothing else to do in life. It's because, not because they're even running away from suffering, but they're running away to something more meaningful. A beautiful thing to do in their life, to inspire other people. And when many, many paths in this life are becoming just a bit meaningless, how much money do you need? How much power do you need? You know, how many children do you need? What's the purpose of life? So actually to be a monk or a nun, where a good monk or a nun, meditating, inspiring, serving, doing a huge amount of good work in this world, it's actually an inspiring lifestyle. If we only had more monasteries and nunneries, then we would. At universities, you know, get the sort of the career day stall. You know, career days when people actually recruit people for IBM or for Apple. They recruit all the most skilled of the graduates, and we should be doing that in universities. Become a monk! Become a nun! Job security, job satisfaction, and retirement out of this world. So anyway, your family, most families don't object. You know, not with a bit of sort of arm twisting. So it's wonderful. Okay, then that's enough. So, that's it, folks. So, this is the last night of this retreat. Are you enlightened yet? Are you going to go home or back to ways and people are going to ask you, what did you get out of this retreat? Nothing. Are you going to be embarrassed? Are you going to be upset? Should you stay up all night and meditate? Go for broke. Everything you've got, go for bust. If you think like that, you haven't listened to a word of what I've been saying all week. So just relax, let it go. And then who knows? The Ananda method might work for you. Give it a try. Hit the pillow. No, it didn't work. So if it doesn't work, then get up in the middle of the night and then try again. Okay. Sadhu. 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 And don't forget to meditate when you go home, and to get up early and do your chanting, and do the three sadhus really loud. That must be grounds for divorce from your partner and your neighbour. But at least you learned a bit of fun and joy and put energy into life. Thank you very much. So good night, everyone. See you tomorrow, maybe.